morning, everyone. Let me know if you can't hear me. I'm notorious for letting my voice drop off a little bit here.
And move away from the back of the room and it starts to go.
Yeah, and really wave because I tend to drift off here. So I am part three of three talks about the Heart Sutra. And I thought I'd do a cheater move and summarize Flo and Claire, but then my brain last Sunday went, oh, her talk's at 10:20, and promptly leapt forward to 11:20 and missed it, and it's not up. That's what happens, right? So anyhow, I will do what I can here with this, and we'll go along. And how long do we go till? I can't remember. I'm so fuzzy. Do we go to 12:15 or 12 or 12 for the talk?
12 to the talk.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So, and I can take my mask off so
yes.
I can have a sip
yep.
of tea. Okay, thank you. It's just a little. Just let me get my. So the Heart Sutra, and. Like a lot of these talks that we do, we start preparing and whatnot, and I don't know about you, but I tend to go down little rabbit holes that I didn't plan on going down. And so the one rabbit hole I got down, which might change the character of this talk, is I picked up this book, My Heart Sutra, A World in 260 Characters by Frederick Schott. And he has got a fascination about the Heart Sutra. And it's 262 in Japanese characters for those. Apparently, I don't know what the extra two are. But he got me going down this little trail of the mantra and the Heart Sutra and why this is our enduring chant everywhere across Asia, the Western world, etc., about Buddhism. And so he relays a story in here about he had an interesting childhood with the parents were in the Forest Service, traveled around the globe, was, you know, high schooled in Japan, and was flying and had a basic fear of flying and was anxious. And this particular time, it was September 12th, the anniversary, 1 year anniversary of 9/11. It also got him thinking about the Japanese airline flight 123, which was one of the worst disasters recorded for airline histories, that they literally slammed into a mountain. And so he was quite tentative, and the pilot was announcing that they were going to do a bit of circling. And he said, you know, he thought that being raised as a Christian, he would have grappled maybe towards a sound or a phrase that was Christian-based, like the Lord's Prayer, but found himself using the Heart Sutra as the of what he was uttering to himself. And even though he realized he had an early fascination with it, and he thought, well, technically, he might have had memorized the entire sutra, the only part of the sutra that he knew was the very last line, which is the mantra of Gate Gata, Paragate, Parasamgate, Bodhisattva. And it helped, and he just sort of, and it just kind of reinforced his pursuit of the Heart Sutra, not as a scholar, not as a religious person, just as what's up with this text and this sutra. And then he does talk about, you know, kind of that times, he was born in the time here where, you know, the beat poets were happening, and Jack Kerouac, Gary Snyder, and having various versions of their renditions of the Heart Sutra, musical renditions, and he even talks about a collaboration, Ginsberg collaborating with a group called The Clash, which is a punk. Anyhow, it's there. You can Google it and look, and it's apparently toward the end of the song, for lack of a better term, you can hear them reciting the Heart Sutra. So this I thought was really interesting, and it kind of got me thinking back to another circumstance where I was, last year I was training, doing my yoga training, and part of the training was this lovely woman called Rishma, and she taught us about Nada Yoga and the yoga of sound, and it involves mantras and repetitions and kirtan and things like that. Ironically, it drove me a bit nuts, and because I don't do repetition well. I sort of have this thing in my head that, you know, I do it, but I do it for the next week and a half, right? So so I tend to shy away from it, but it harkened back to, we're talking about sutra and we're talking about mantra, and she spoke, and so does Schultz, about talking to people that talk about mantra as being extremely spiritual derived, and that it comes from deep meditation and a rising that just comes forth. It's not contrived like you might do with poetry or something where you might puzzle over it. That's how spiritually directed it is. And so her definition that she, you know, a mantra is a revealed word, phrase, or set of words, or divine sound. And so there's lots of, you know, the mantras and slokas and sutis and seed, where they're potent sound formulas. So ones that we would be familiar with are like om or gom, you know, and repetitions of sounds like that. Then, of course, into the Indian music system, tracing back to 2,000 years in the Vedic hymns of the Hindu temples, the fundamental source of all Indian music is based on mantra and devotional songs. And these patterns were something that's very similar to us. We have one here, a devotional song with a call and response, Ganase Saranam Saranam Ganase Sersha Saranam Saranam Sashe, which is Ganesh Ganasa, we seek your help, protection, you are our shelter. So then I got exploring a little bit more, and various authors here that I use, that mantras closely resemble, even overlap, what we are called dharana, or summaries of a longer, more important text. So, and then Oxford Dictionary, mantra is originally in Sanskrit, in a sacred text or passage, especially one from the Vedas, used as a prayer or incantation, a word or phrase from a sacred text, repeated, also a holy name, or for inward meditation. And so Schultz here, he also talks about other definitions about strings of thought, rhythmical chants, a song, or the physical action of scribing the mantra or scribing the sutra. For example, doing scroll work. Don't know which way it is. And there's all these different, Michael will show, but I got some show and tell. But this is a little sidebar, because I've been studying Mandarin and I got a little excited when I was looking at some of the scrolls and I recognized a couple of characters. So in there, when they talk about the Heart Sutra, and I'll pass around a book too, one calligraphy version of the heart or core is this. And then the other thing they will talk about, and we know that in the practice of it, is that it's full of negation words or characters, and so that's in there. So it's just brisk with, and when you look at it, you know. I get oddly excited about the strange things. It actually reminded me, I don't know if you guys ever have a recollection of learning to read, and the minute that, and I went, oh, you know, and it was that same little pop. It was just one word, but it was the same little pop. So anyway, I digress. Let me see here. I'm not shuffling too loud for the, you know. Let me catch myself here. So, Heart Sutra, and is a tendency for Western interpretations to use more of the notion of the romantic heart, as opposed to a meaning which is essence or core. And you'll see that in a lot of languages where the two are used essentially as the same. And that to remember that mantra belongs to the esoteric tradition and accordingly belongs to the five kinds of texts deemed primal, untranslatable, inconceivable when they are translated and explained. And they will become conceivable Dharma in their original meaning, and merit will be lost. Another fellow, Karl Brunholz, Buddhist translator of Tibetan and author of The Heart Attack Sutra, which I want to get a copy of because I love that title. What can we say about the Heart Sutra is that it is completely crazy. If we read it, it doesn't make any sense. When we read it, it sounds nuts, but that's actually where the wisdom part comes in. And also, Schultz says, and we could also argue, but there's something about this sutra, this mantra, thus remains a sonic bridge among diverse languages and cultures, one that has survived nearly intact for over 14,000 years, would suggest it might even go back to 2000. And it has survived because it's a mantra. So then I thought, you know, I could just drop it right here because we don't have to do anything more, but that wouldn't be right. So I had the last four lines here, and so I'm going to go through a bit of the line by line. But I think it's useful to hold that whole notion that, you know, there's things that we're not going to understand and that it actually, in fact, goes beyond that. So I'm sure Claire took you right up to where I'm going to go in my line, and you probably, if you need your book, you can take a look, but I'm going to just tweeze out the last few lines. Starting with, far beyond all inverted views, one realizes nirvana. And you'll even see in translations that inverted will be perverted. There's lots of variation on that. But the general consensus, be it Japanese, tendo musu, mu being dream, so being thinking, that a lot of our attitude or understanding is done in a dream-like state that is created from our own karmic experience. And even in the phrase tendo, meaning upside down, it's our experience is limited, and yet we think it's the whole world. So we are like a frog in the well. This is Okumuro. We can only see a small circle of the sky, but we think we are seeing the whole universe. And so that we have to bear in mind that we have unique perspectives, but thought is only one part of our life, and realize that what we think is not reality. Some other assumptions that our thoughts operate our body and mind, and this too is upside down. And when we become flexible, when we free ourselves from fixed views, this is the prajna, or the wisdom. Another translator, Red Pine, he too talks about other words that you'll find in these sutras, depending on which rendition that you use, that viprasana refers to what is upside down, what is contrary to the way things are, and what we're getting mixed up are our four classic delusions used to establish the mundane world, samsara, claiming something is permanent, that it is not, pleasurable, that it is not, self-existent, that is not, pure, that is not. And because of this upside down thinking, wrong perceptions that we believe to be true. So some examples of, you know, we might believe that drugs will bring happiness, but we end up being a slave to those drugs. We might believe power and riches make us secure, and we end up feeling fearful, jealousy, and anxiety. So in the part two of the sentence, one realizes nirvana. And this is quite tricky too. Different interpretations and translations of nirvana. And this is from Red Pine again. The notion that you do not reach or attain nirvana, but rather overcome all delusions, including the goal of nirvana. It too holds the four delusions, nirvana being the final delusion. And he also reiterates these dreamlike states and seeing through them and not giving rise to them. And Thich Nhat Hanh, in his book, To the Other Shore, talking about nirvana, because there are no more obstacles in their minds, bodhisattvas, they can overcome all fear, destroy all wrong perceptions, and realize perfect nirvana. So it comes when we let go of our notions of a separate self and our wrong perceptions. We are no longer afraid. And I appreciate this part of his analysis that speaks of without non-fear, the relief from suffering in is not complete. Only with no fear can there be true peace and happiness. Nirvana means extinction, not a place that you go. It's not in the future. Nirvana is the nature of reality as it is. It is available here and now. You are already in Nirvana. It is our true nature. We are perfectly in Nirvana. And then Thich Nhat Hanh, who likes to come up with words, we have been nirvanarized from the non-beginning. He loves playing with language. So there, next lines. All Buddhas of past, present, and future rely on prajnaparamita and thereby attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. And so we'll break that one down even further. You can just break this down word by word. So all Buddhas of past, present, and future, the three worlds, and nothing is relative. There's no separation between self, others, and all beings. That is enlightenment. And again, we can liberate ourselves from the slaves of thought, slaves of the ego, into bodhisattvas. And I do recall with Flo saying, it doesn't mean there's an annihilation of practice. There isn't, you know, that, okay, that's cool, we're done. We still continue to practice, but we kind of keep a kind of an egotistical check in there. And then rely on prajnaparamita. And one interpretation by Ridvan, instead of nirvana for bodhisattvas, that they take refuge in prajnaparamita. For it is the womb of prajnaparamita that Buddhas are born, and the mother of Buddhas. So it's the actual refuge. The Buddhas of past, present, and future take no other road and use only this gate because they realize fundamental wisdom without being attached to anything. It says they take refuge in prajnaparamita, suggesting Buddhas and ordinary people aren't really different. Buddhas are simply people who are free of birth, death, love, and hate, and thereby obtain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. Another sidebar on the perfect enlightenment. One Red Pine talks about this in terms, if I understood it correctly, was this basically was a qualifier to distinguish between other sects of, not deities, so a bodhisattva versus a Shabarakas, who's a follower, versus a Pratya Buddha, who's a solitary Buddha without the aid of teachers and guides. And so bodhisattvas embed in prajnaparamita. That's how they come to their definition. And a bit more here, all Buddhas, and so we talked about past, present, and future. And so present would be what I'd be looking at. And who else can be enlightened? And everyone and every being has a seed in enlightenment. This is Thich Nhat Hanh. Not a matter of time, it can happen in an instant. Practicing mindfulness of breathing and walking, learn to let the Buddha breathe and walk for us. You learn to become the Buddha, and the Buddha learns to become you. It's all very easy. In the beginning, you might be a part-time Buddha. Go to full-time Buddha and fall back to part-time Buddha. You can become a Buddha whenever and wherever you like. It's really nice because we're a human being and the Buddha is always there. Yeah. So now we get into, we're getting close. So therefore, know the prajnaparamita is the great miraculous mantra, the great bright mantra, the supreme mantra, the incomparable mantra, which removes all suffering and is true, not false. So Okamura, taking just the first part, therefore know the prajnaparamita, Prajnaparamita is the wisdom to see impermanence and interdependence. The body and mind exist as a result of many factors. The Heart Sutra says that this prajna or wisdom, which sees the reality of impermanence, egolessness, and interdependence, is mantra. In Red Pine, he even takes it down a little bit further with the word know. And that we know we can know this, we know this mantra because it involves no knowledge. Rather, it leads beyond knowledge, the only form of knowledge cultivated by a bodhisattva. I had this flash, I could be wrong, but it sort of reminded me of this, the knowledge cultivated by a bodhisattva, and it's like the only food of a bodhisattva's incense or the Buddha's, right? It's like that's all you need. A little incense and a little sutra. Knowledge turns out to be no knowledge. That turns out to be the only knowledge worth knowing. They, the mantras, are the creations of beings in touch with the underlying vibrations of the mind and the keys that unlock its power through sympathetic harmonics. And so when we look back on the sutra and we read and remember, where they looked deeply into the five skandhas and saw that they were all empty, that's a result of this deep meditation and the suggestion that this is where it emerged. As for all the names, well, this is just one cluster of names, and I'm sure you could go down and explore all of those in their own beings. Other names, the mantra of great magic, unexcelled mantra, mantra equal to the unequaled, is a great mantra, illuminating mantra, the highest mantra. Then there's another fellow, Edward Conzi, he's quoted in Red Pine here on the magical notion of mantras and sutras, the great spell, the spell of great knowledge, the utmost spell, the unequal spell, a layer of all suffering, in truth a supreme spell, the one and only spell. So just a different language, and so probably is when it starts to become useful to remember that maybe these things can't be truly interpreted. And then the second part reveals, so he's talked about what it is and then the function of the sutra or the mantra to remove suffering. So they talked about the qualification. It's a qualification that it's true. Buddha taught suffering, the origin of suffering, end of suffering, the path leading to the end of suffering. At the end of the sutra, Avalokiteshvara returns to the beginning, suffering in the way out of suffering. But to keep Shariputra from treating this insight as another level of intellectual understanding, a skill that Shariputra was best known for, Avalokiteshvara directs him instead to the mantra, the Sanskrit, the mantra, which also, there's another meaning here, which means to heal and also to calm. So even there, they were, get it out of your head. So we finally get to, we proclaim the Prajnaparamita mantra, the mantra that says, and even Red Pine takes this down back, which I thought is interesting, where he changes it, that the mantra in the Prajnaparamita, it's embedded, and we can see that. And that mantra is something you utter with your body, mind, and breath, and are at one in deep concentration. Avalokiteshvara, looking deeply into the five skandhas, saw nature of interbeing and overcame all pain, became completely liberated, and in that state of deep concentration, joy, liberation, that they uttered this powerful mantra, Gate, Gate, Paragate, Parasamgate, Bodhisattva. And again, Zen and Buddhism, so you'll get one line. The words themselves are believed to have divine power and are not translated. And yet, we have various translations which may give people comfort. Gone, gone, gone beyond. Gone altogether beyond. Oh, what an awakening. Gone, gone, gone across, or burnt out. Gone across forever, Bodhisattva. O wisdom, gone, gone to the other shore, landed at the other shore, Sava, gone, gone, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond. Oh, what an awakening. All hail. So what to do with this mantra? Kaz Ta-Nehisi, who we have scrolls. There's something magical about reciting without fully understanding the words. This may be similar to the experience of people who love praying in Latin at Roman Catholic churches. And I think even sometimes I thought, well, that, you know, we talk about that when we recite it in Japanese, most of us don't understand. But you know what? In English, we're not understanding it a whole lot either. So there may be, it may not be as rhythmic and melodic as the Sanskrit versions and things like that. But it's certainly there. And that it's best not to even try to understand it intellectually, but just to learn to chant it and absorb it, letting the vibrations seep through one's body, almost like learning a song. And they also talk about doing that as a practice, a calligraphy practice. We can't, people that write it out every day, just do the calligraphy and then move on. They don't pay, they're just looking and absorbed in the characters and not paying too much to that. And I could see where that would be kind of interesting. I need to learn more characters before I do that. So to kind of close here, we will be chanting it and we're going to be forgiven because it should have been the full moon, but it just seemed like we should chant it. And I like, this is Okamura talk, it's about chanting. Chanting allows us to communicate with each other deeply without speaking. Chant with your hara, your abdomen, not with your mouth. Chanting is a practice of deep breathing with your abdomen. Chant with your ear, not with your mouth. Listen to what others are chanting. Be together. Don't chant alone. The chanting should be one, like a chorus or an orchestra. Chanting enables us to be right now, right here. We have to put our whole body and mind into chanting and letting go of other things. Don't think about errands, how you're sitting, how you sound. Just here and now, 100%. In this way, chanting is mantra. The meaning is not so important. Nice, but not the point. He actually says that. It can open your eyes to reality. It's not an intellectual reality, but rather to our life energy. When we chant wholeheartedly, our voice is the sound of emptiness. And that's the title of his chapter about the Heart Sutra, is the sound of emptiness. So I thank you for joining me. Close.
Chant on page 3.